My name is Faye Williams, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And in keeping with what's traditional in Arkansas, my sobriety date is April the 12th, 1982, and my home group, thank you, SLA, my home group is the Courage to Change group in Little Rock. I also send greetings from the original Little Rock 120 and a half Main Street group, which I realized today recently celebrated a birthday. They've had a continuous meeting schedule in Little Rock since early March 1940, one of the earliest AA groups. And we have strong AA in Little Rock. I want to thank the committee. Brittany's been running her legs off me ever since she got here, finding things that I needed to be comfortable. Ronnie called me some time ago and asked me if I would speak. And then I heard from Donnie. And then I heard from Don. And I'm wondering if there are any men in Oklahoma that aren't Ronnie's or Donnie's. I'm sure there are. It's good to see Don. And I see some other old friends here. And I feel very welcome. I feel that I'm at an AA intergroup, and that's exactly where I need to be tonight. This is not my favorite thing to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I came to you, I could not share myself at all with anyone. Groups of people scared me to death. I spent the last 5 years of my drinking locked up in my house to drink, terrified of people. And I've come a long way through the power of this program since then. I'm very grateful that I had a sponsor that when I have a fear, suggested that I walk through that fear with the power that I found here rather than running away. And God has brought me on some of the most wonderful adventures in the last almost 15 years by following that suggestion. I don't say no to Alcoholics Anonymous when I'm asked for the simple reason that I was sponsored that way. And I soon learned that there's a purpose in that, because I'm not in control of my life anymore. And when I say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I mean a legitimate request like coming to talk to us and share myself with you, you better believe there's going to be something in it for me, something that I need. I have no idea what it is. I don't need to know at this point, but someday I do know. It always comes back to me, and that's what it's all about. The big book says that our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like today. And to give you a little bit of an idea of what I used to be like, I was born in Georgia some time ago. That's a good beginning. My father was a lumberman. He was a band sawyer, a contract band sawyer, and we moved from lumber mill to lumber mill town, little sawmill towns. They're ghost towns today. I've gone back to visit some of them in sobriety, and they are ghost towns today. It's a way of life that is vanishing because of the technology today. But I grew up very poor. I lived in real poverty as a child. I was the youngest of 7 children, and we moved constantly. I never had roots. When I was 14, my father died suddenly. My father was like my God. He was my anchor. He was the person I always anchored myself to. I felt that I had a mother that was very scolding, very critical of me. And when my father died when I was 14, it was like my world came crashing in on me. Within 2 years, I was married. I had found a man to take care of me and get me out of that poverty. I married a man who had one stripe in the Air Force, so I was right back into poverty and moving all over the place. By the time I was 22, I had 4 children. Now, that used to be my story. Today, let me tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. This is an illness, and it's an illness, a disease of perception. And my perception was warped when I got to you. What the beauty of this program has done is to go through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with a sponsor in the pages of the Big Book, and I'm a Big Book thumper. Actually, I'm not a thumper, I'm a reader. I read that book and I study that book, and it's my life today. It's a program for living, a design for living, and it always works. And let me tell you something about this story I just told you. I used to get a lot of mileage out of that, and I could make you cry. I was such a victim. Life really handed me some tough deals. But because of AA, and because today I see a glass that's half full instead of half empty, because my memories have totally changed and altered, the same events appear different to me because my attitude has changed. I am a different person today than the one that you took in almost 15 years ago. The poverty I told you about made me a very strong person. You know, there's a promise in the Big Book that fear of economic insecurity will leave us. It doesn't say economic insecurity will leave us. It says the fear will leave us. My memory of my childhood today, I didn't even know we were poor. Everybody around me was poor. I had no one to compare myself with. And I lived in a time when there was no television set. Now I'm beginning to tell you my age. And I had no way of knowing that I was poor. My needs were met one day at a time. My family took care of me, and the God of my understanding was with me even then. The first time I had any inkling that we lived a little different than other people was when I moved into a large city when I was in junior high school. The gift from the inventory process and the sharing with another human being in Alcoholics Anonymous is I came to understand that because I grew up in poverty, I have a wealth of experience that I can walk around today knowing that no matter how poor I may become in my life, one day at a time, there's a power and a source that continues to meet my needs and take care of me. I have no fear of that. And I feel very grateful for that. I have had a wealth of experience that's very beneficial to me because my attitude has changed. The death of my father when I was 14 gave me the need within myself to get an education, and I became the first woman in my family to go through college. And it was a blessing because I saw my mother with no skills and young children at home having to make do. And I did not want to be in that position someday. So I'm very grateful today. I can look back and say, yes, it was sad that at 14 I lost my father, but I see a lot of blessings that came out of that death. I may never have gotten an education. I may have been like the other women in my family and seen no need for it. I'm grateful today that I know that I can be self-supporting through my own contributions. I can look back in my life today and everything that happened in my life was right on time, just as it should have been, and I'm no longer a victim of life or of anyone or anything, including alcoholism. I took my first drink when I was 16, a sip of champagne at my wedding. I didn't like the taste. I didn't drink again until I was 22. I went to a neighborhood party, a friend put a drink in my hand and said, try it, you'll like it. And I did, and I did. By the time I was 22 and I had these four small children, all preschoolers, and at that time no education, and had been married since I was 16, for 6 years at 22, that drink made me instantly everything I ever wanted to be. I was intelligent, and I was witty, and I was charming. I was sexy. I was beautiful. I was the life of the party. I was the center of attention, and I loved it. The second drink, I got drunk. My arms felt heavy, and I remember thinking, this is what they mean by being stoned. And it wasn't pot, you guys. It was booze. It didn't matter. I was stoned. My arms felt like they weighed 1,000 pounds, and I couldn't get out of the chair, and I was getting violently ill.
The girl that was mixing the drinks probably laced them pretty heavy. My husband was sitting across the room, and I looked over at him, and I said, "Bob," and he saw this tail, and he came over, and he picked me up, and he carried me down the hall, and I'm not a small woman. I wasn't then. He carried me into the bathroom. It was an old house with high ceilings and big rooms, and everyone at the party followed us. And I said the most sincere prayer of my life down on my knees in front of the goddess. Oh, God, if you'll get me out of this, I'll never do it again. And all of these people in that room watching me saying, "Oh, bless her heart. Oh, I know how she feels." And I'm thinking, I'm not pretty. I'm not intelligent. I'm not witty. I'm still the life of the party and the center of attention, and I hate it. But if it's the last thing I ever do, I'm going to learn to drink like a lady. Now, this thing has made me very ill. It's put me in a very uncomfortable position, but I have found what I needed. Because for just a little while, it gave me the perception that everything about me was okay. It gave me that sense of ease and comfort. It made me become what I wanted to be and couldn't be. I've just suddenly had a thought that I want to share with you because I don't want to forget it later on in the story. But the first time I ever shared my story from the podium, I only had a few months of sobriety, and one of the old-timers had called and suggested that it was time, that I needed to share myself with the group. And when I got up before the podium and I told my story, when I sat down, he got up through the microphone and said, "You have just heard a woman share that when she took her first drink, she became intelligent, attractive, sexy, witty, and the center of attention. And you have seen that woman tonight become all those things without having to drink to do it." And I really held on to that. And you know, I knew in that moment it was true. I had been all those things that night, the first time I really shared myself with you, and you made that possible, and the God of my understanding made that possible, because I had never been able to share myself in front of a group of people. I get paralyzed with fright in front of a group of people, but not in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I, when I was 40 years old, I was at the peak of my life in every way. Every goal I had ever set for myself, I had attained. I had the all-American dream. I had managed to get the education. I still had the marriage. I had the four children. I had two grandchildren before I was 40, and they were precious. I had a very successful career. I no longer lived in poverty. I lived in a beautiful home in a beautiful neighborhood. I was truly a self-made woman. I had set all my goals and attained them all, and I was sitting in my den with a drink in my hand, crying and wanting to take my life, terrified that I was going to do it because I no longer felt that I had anything to live for. And I remember that scene. Any time I try to tell myself that anything outside of me can make me happy, it cannot. The woman that had attained all her dreams, had the all-American dream, had everything in my life I had ever wanted to die, and didn't know what was wrong. I did not know what was wrong with me. I put myself into counseling, and I spent the next 3 years in counseling talking about that man and those kids and that boss. They had to be the problem. And for 3 years, I did that. And then when I saw I was not getting anywhere except that one day at a time, I didn't kill myself. And during that time, my sister did. I flew home to my sister's funeral, and my sister was like me. She had the same personality. My dad could not tell us apart in photographs when we were younger. And she drank like me. Her personality was like mine, and she looked like me. And she took her life during that time. And I knew that my suicidal tendency was very real. God put, at that time, everyone in my life that I needed. And I remember standing over my sister in her coffin and feeling the anger that such a beautiful woman and my sister was. She had a light, a lamp that would light up the room, had done that to herself. And I made a vow that that I could not do. I couldn't put my mother through it again, and I couldn't put the family through it a second time. So the option of suicide was no longer there. That had been taken from me. And I'm very grateful, of course, today. When I saw that the counseling wasn't working, I couldn't straighten out him, and I couldn't straighten out the kids, and I couldn't straighten out the boss. I put myself out of counseling, and for the next year, just got deeper and deeper into locking myself up in the house to drink. I was going to work every day. I was a functioning drunk. I got up in the morning with a hangover. It got to be a normal part of my life to get up with a headache and with the shakes and the dry heaves and sometimes not so dry heaves. To wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and have to get a drink of water, not knowing that it really, honestly, I did not realize that it was something else I was craving besides water at 2 o'clock in the morning, but wondering why I woke up every morning at 2 o'clock dying of thirst. I remember one time I rolled over and put my hand on my husband's chest, and he was covered in sweat, and so was I. And he said, "Are you awake?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I can tell you without looking at the clock what time it is. It's 2 o'clock in the morning." I said, "How do you know that?" He said, "I wake up at this time every morning in a sweat, and I don't know what's wrong." And I said, "Bob, you know, I read recently in a magazine that people that get night sweats usually have either lung disease or alcoholism." And everything was quiet for a little bit. And then he said, "Do you think we have TB?" So I went down the next day and I got myself checked, and then I came in a week later and said, I went back for my checkup, and I, "We can relax, we don't have TB." But the conversation never came up again. Isn't that interesting? In 1981, Bob was away on a business trip. This man I'd been married to at that time, 27 years. And I got up at 7:30 in the morning, and it was my day off, and it was time to clean the house. The children were all grown and out of the house by then. I was there alone. And increasingly, over the last few years, like I said, I did nothing but go to work and then drop off at the liquor store, get my bottle, and then drink myself into oblivion before I got up in the morning and did it all over again. And at 7:30 in the morning, I went downstairs, I opened the kitchen cabinet, and there was a bottle with cinnamon in it. And that was a miracle, because I always brought my rum, the amount that I needed to do the day's work. I drank, like I say, sober. I drank a day at a time. And I tried to limit my drinks that way. I would buy just enough booze to get me through the evening to do what I knew needed to be done so that I could get up the next day and go to work. I realized today that with me, keeping my job had become very important, because my marriage wasn't as benevolent as it used to be. This man that I was married to kept locking up his booze so that I couldn't get my hands on it. He had his stash in the back of the house, and so I had to supply my own, and that meant that I had to keep the job. So in order to keep the job, I had to limit myself. And this is not a conscious decision I was making, but if this, anything I tell you is in hindsight. But I had a little bit of rum left, and usually I fill the bottle before I went to bed. And I thought when I saw that rum in the cabinet, this is what I need. If I just had a little bit of rum to start the day, because my head was killing me and I was shaking all over, and I knew I had this big house to clean up. And so as I reached for that bottle, I heard a little voice in my head. And, you know, I have this committee that meets in my head. We hear every show, you know, it talks to me. The longer I stay sober, the more that committee sleeps. My voices really do sleep a lot today. My mind very often is very quiet. And it's not boring at all. It's very peaceful. But at that time, I had a lot of voices that spoke to me. And this little voice in my head said, alcoholics drink at 7:30 in the morning as I'm reaching for this bottle. And I thought, that's true. Alcoholics drink at 7:30 in the morning. And I went to put it back, and the next voice said, but there are nurses getting off work all over town at 7:30 in the morning. And they're going to go home, and they're going to kick off their shoes and have a drink. Isn't that what everybody does when they get off work? And if they can do it at 7:30 in the morning, so can you. So I had a drink for the nurses getting off work at 7:30 in the morning. And it really worked. It's not the first time I had drank at 7:30, but it is honestly the first time I'd ever drank at 7:30 in the morning alone. Not a Bloody Mary on the way to an Arkansas Razorback football game, but alone in my home at 7:30 in the morning. And it felt good. It really worked for me that day. I had more and more become a sloppy drunk, one that loves to sit in the corner and cry when they drink. But what happened, strange phenomenon. When the liquor store opened that morning, I was at the door. And I didn't know what I know today, that once I put that rum in my body, I had to have more. The phenomenon of craving. I thought everybody felt that way. I didn't realize that there was anything wrong with me. So I bought me a half a pint of rum when the liquor store opened, because I was going to limit my drink so that I could get done what I had to do that day. Before the day was over, I'd been to 3 liquor stores. And if there's anyone here that does not understand why I went to 3 different liquor stores, see me after the meeting and I will explain that to you. But I went to 3 liquor stores before the day was over, and at around 6 or 6:30 that afternoon, my house was spotless. And I was feeling good. And I had just enough rum left to get me through the evening. And I was just about ready to kick off my shoes and prop up my feet and enjoy the evening with the rum I had left and this shiny house and the sense of accomplishment that I'd gotten it done. But I wasn't too steady on my feet. And as I was taking the last dishes out of the dishwasher to finish up my day, I dropped the bowl. It broke. I stepped on it barefooted, and I began to bleed. No big deal, but I couldn't get the bleeding to stop, and I lost a great deal of blood. It was not an artery, but I tried everything. I tried the pressure. I tried everything I could think of, and I began to panic, and I had a lot of blood in that house before it was over. And I realized today that I probably had more rum in my vein than I did clotting factors in my blood, and we do have a tendency, we alcoholics, to bleed to death when we've had too much to drink, if we have an accident. Our clotting factors are not always very healthy. So I began to panic, and this girl that wanted to die, that wanted to take her own life, realized that I didn't have control over the situation, and that was altogether different. Now I wanted to live. I didn't want to sit there in my own den and bleed to death. I had to get help. And that was when one of those moments of awakening began for me, that I really had no one in my life I felt that I could pick up the phone and call. I had a physician that lived across the street and a minister that lived next door, and I was too ashamed and embarrassed to call my neighbors and say, I've had too much to drink, I've had an injury, I need to go to the hospital, will you help me? That pride killed me, but I was ashamed. And I understand that today. That's part of this illness. I didn't want to call an ambulance for the same reason. I didn't want to call attention to myself. And I remember crying hysterically, and I have never felt so alone. I thought, I have lived to this point in my life and accomplished all these goals, and I can literally sit here and bleed to death, and there's nobody in my world that I trust enough to call. I didn't want to call one of my grown children for the same reason. I was too ashamed of what I had become. A person who had to lock myself up and close my drapery, deadbolt my door, and not answer my phone in order to do every night for myself what I had to do for myself. Quietly get drunk and pass out. And I screamed out loud, God help me. There's nobody on this earth that could possibly understand what I'm going through. And I heard a voice. And this time it was not in my head. It was external to me. It came out of the wall behind my head. And it just calmly and quietly and gently said, an alcoholic would understand. I had taken enough courses in psychology, I'm in a health field, to know what a hallucination was, and it scared me to death. I also know that I had three sisters that had them, and they locked all three of them up in mental hospitals, and that I was going to go to my grave without telling a soul that I had heard a voice and no one was there. I also had enough sense to know that it was brought on by the alcohol, that perhaps I'd had a little bit too much to drink that day, and that is what brought on the hallucination. But the miracle of that voice that said an alcoholic would understand, the miracle of it is it made sense to me. And I thought, I bet an alcoholic would understand. I bet alcoholics sit in a lot worse positions than I'm in. And if I could find one that wasn't drinking, I wouldn't have to be ashamed to call them and say, I need help. I've had too much to drink, and I fended myself and need to go to the hospital. But where do you find an alcoholic who's not drinking? I raised four kids with a husband that was very rarely at home because he was in the military, and I knew how to shop when I couldn't get out. I picked up the Yellow Pages, and I looked up alcoholism, and AA was the first listing. And then I went down, because in my mind, I didn't know anything about AA. I had studied a paragraph or two in psychology. I mean, you know, these were a bunch of alcoholics that held on to each other and kept each other from drinking. I pictured dirty old men that sat under bridges, didn't bathe and didn't shave, that held on to each other and white-knuckled it to keep from drinking. And I thought that was wonderful for them, but I certainly didn't fall in that category. So I kept looking in the Yellow Pages. And then I came back to AA. And it was a while before it dawned on me that what I was doing, I was afraid I might run into the doctor across the street or the minister next door. And I wanted to talk to an alcoholic so that I would not be ashamed. I needed you then before I knew I needed you, and I still need you today. I can still tell you things about me that I can't tell others. There's a connection there that I don't understand and I don't have to. It's just there. I accept it and I'm so grateful for it. You've saved my life. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I'm not an alcoholic, but I've had too much to drink and I've injured myself and I need to go to the hospital. And I was told, if you will give us your first name and your phone number, we'll have someone call you as soon as possible. And I did. And I no sooner hung up the phone and it rang. And it was a woman. It wasn't a dirty old man. It was a woman. And she said, my name is Mary Ann, and she gave me her full name over the telephone. And I'm an alcoholic. Can I help you? And I thought, my God, this woman told me her full name and told me something so shameful about herself. I can't believe this. Why, I could blackmail this woman. Does it matter? And I said, well, Marianne, I'm not an alcoholic. But I've had too much to drink it, and I've injured myself, and I'm losing a great deal of blood, and I wondered if you could take me to the hospital. And she said, give me your address. My husband is also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the two of us will be able to pick you up as soon as possible. And I thought, here comes the dirty old man. And the problem is, one dirty old man I could handle, but a dirty old man in his mall, I could sit here and bleed to death, and my husband could get home and find my corpse on the floor and everything in the house wiped out that we've worked for. 27 years we've been working so hard to get what we've got. So I'm sitting there bleeding to death, and I decide that I need to take references. I need to know something about Mary Ann. So I said, Mary Ann, would you please tell me something about yourself? And Mary Ann said, well, I own my own business. I have an office here in Little Rock and one in Memphis. My husband's an attorney. And I thought, I looked around the house and I thought, I don't think I've got anything these people need. So I gave her my address. The voice that came out of the wall almost 15 years later, I can tell you in all sincerity, was the voice of my higher power. Nor am I ashamed to say that the next thing that happened on that phone with Mary Ann was the voice of my higher power speaking to me. And she didn't say what I expected her to say. My higher power has a sense of humor and never does or says what I expect him to do or say. Because Mary Ann said, Faye, you seem rather upset. Why don't you fix yourself another drink and prop your foot up, and we'll be there as soon as we can. And since then, I have found that in working with others in Chapter 7 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I told Mary Ann I was not an alcoholic. She didn't argue the point with me. And if she had, I may not be standing here talking to you today. Mary Ann said, fix yourself another drink. See, Mary Ann was an alcoholic in recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she knew that I had already begun to drink, and it was going to be very difficult for me to stop that night, and particularly as upset as I was. She also knew I had told her I was not an alcoholic. She validated me. She didn't argue with me. But she put me in a very uncomfortable position. The first thing that happened when I hung up that phone and hobbled in the kitchen to make myself another drink was, the thought that went through my head was, this is wonderful. Those people don't care if you drink around them. The next thing that hit me was, but how can she do that? If Mary Ann is an alcoholic and can be around me when I drink, I'm not an alcoholic and I can't do that. Something's wrong. So I went back in the bed and sat down with my rum and coke and started unwrapping my foot, and guess what? The bleeding had stopped. And I thought, wonderful. I don't have to have those drunks in my house. I can cancel this call. And I picked up the phone and I started dialing to cancel the call, and right in the middle I hung up the phone. Because I had to see if Mary Ann could sit in my den and watch me drink and not have to have a drink of alcohol. If she could do that, there was something bad wrong with me. Two beautiful people came to my door that night, and what followed was a 12-step call right out of the 7th chapter of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The two of them, when I told them I no longer needed to go to the hospital, but would they please come in because I'd never met any alcoholics before, came in and had a seat in my den, and they answered my questions, and they shared themselves with me. They never once tried to convince me that I had a drinking problem. Mary Ann said some things about herself that night that disturbed me very, very much. I kept thinking, how does she know this about me? How does she know to share these things? They're making me very uncomfortable. And all she was doing was talking about herself and how this illness affected her. Now I'm going to tell you something about Mary Ann and Bill. Bill had been sober for a number of years. I still run into Bill occasionally, and it's just absolutely amazing the results of that 12-step call, and it's far more reaching than this girl standing here, this girl. That's what I am tonight sharing with you. But he had several years of sobriety and really didn't open his mouth very much that night. Mary Ann was the one that I identified with and that I listened to and that attracted me. She was so enthusiastic. And I ran into Mary Ann recently at a convention, and I told her one more time, Mary Ann, you made one heck of a 12-step call. And the results still blow me away. And Mary Ann said, you know, Faye, she said, I shared something with you that night that I don't think you heard. When I made that call on you, I had 3 weeks of sobriety. 3 weeks of sobriety. But Mary Ann was so enthusiastic about what she had found in Alcoholics Anonymous that she made me want what she had. And that's why I'm here tonight. 3 weeks. They got up to leave and they said, we need to go to a meeting and you're welcome to come if you'd like to. And I said, but I'm not an alcoholic. And Mary Ann said, Faye, you've made that perfectly clear. But you are interested. You've asked so many questions that I thought you might like to see what an AA meeting is like. And we have open meetings of AA. And I said, what's that? And she said, well, anyone can go to an open meeting. And I said, who would go to a meeting of AA? And I said, we're an alcoholic. And she said, we get family members. And we get people that are interested, like doctors, clergymen. And then we get people like you that are just curious. And so I went. I went that night, hobbling on this badly injured foot that still gives me problems from time to time, and it's a wonderful reminder of where I came from. And that room, it was 120 and a half, the oldest group in Arkansas, one of the oldest in the nation, and it was full of people. It was a very large meeting, and people were laughing and enjoying themselves, enjoying each other, and I saw about 4 or 5 people that looked real sick, and I knew they were the alcoholics, and all of these other people were those family members and clergymen and doctors and curious people. They had turned out to help these poor, sick people. I was not one of them, you understand. I was there as a curious person. The man that got up and told his story was obviously an alcoholic, and I identified not at all. He had all kinds of divorces. He'd been in jail any number of times. He talked about geographic cues and blackouts. All these jobs he had lost. I didn't have any of those things. I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic. But at one point, the next miracle occurred that night. He talked about standing on the Arkansas River Bridge and looking down at the river and saying, God help me. There's nobody on the face of this earth that could possibly understand what I'm going through. And I felt my skin crawl. And I thought, what is happening here? Those are the very same words that came out of my mouth just about 2 hours ago. And now I'm hearing them come out of the mouth of a perfect stranger. I identified with that man. And that kept me coming back to you for quite a while. I don't know how long, because I've lost some memory in there. When I came to you, I admitted I was paralyzed over alcohol. But because I hadn't had all those things happen to me, I could not admit the unmanageability of my life. I didn't know that then. I know it today. I was still signing my checks, still going on my job, still needing, you know, paying my bills. I wasn't having all these problems that you kept talking about. So how could I be a real alcoholic? What I did during those 2 months, though, the seeds, you planted so many seeds in me that saved my life, even when I didn't quite identify. One day at a time, you said, don't drink. One day at a time, I didn't drink. And I found it a lot easier than I thought that in 1981, and it was because you were walking that walk with me. You told me, don't drink, at least for the newcomers, are the 5 things that saved my life that the old timers told me, and these are the 5 things that I still do today. Don't drink. Go to meetings. Read the big book. Call your sponsor and work the steps. One day at a time, doing those things, it works. And so one day at a time, I didn't drink. I went to meetings when my husband was out of town, and when he was in town, I stayed home like a good Georgia wife should. That's how I grew up. But I went to meetings when he was out of town. You understand, when he was in town, before I came to you, I still drank. I drank whether he was in town or out of town, but when I was getting sober, suddenly it was important to be a good wife, and so I stayed home with him when he was home, and I went to AA meetings when he was out of town. I read the big book in one night. It was an easy read. It was on about a 5th grade reading level, and I was used to much heavier books, and it was a sweet little book that didn't particularly apply to me, but it was fine for you. Call your sponsor. I needed a sponsor to do that. So the first little gal that smiled at me, I said, will you be my sponsor? And she said, I can't do that. And I said, why not? I felt instant rejection. I've been locked up for 5 years in my own home and seriously avoiding people, more and more becoming isolated. And now the first person I reached out to told me, I can't do that. Rejection. I said, why not? And she said, I just got here a month ahead of you. I haven't even taken inventory yet. And I said, what's that? And she said, I don't know. That's what I'm trying to figure out. And I said, if I can't have you, I don't want anyone. And I could stop and say, I tried to get a sponsor and I've been rejected. And she came up to me at the next meeting I saw her at and said, oh, by the way, I talked to my sponsor about you. And she told me that I should go ahead and sponsor you. Because with your attitude, I can't harm you and it might do me some good. So I had a sponsor. And when I was in meetings like this, and there was some old person up at the podium talking about things I didn't understand, I worked the steps during the meeting. I've done that. Yeah, I think I've done that all right. I'm doing fine. I checked myself out and I was okay. And one day at a time, I didn't drink. One night after the meeting, I told an old-timer, one of the guys, I said, look, I don't identify with you guys. You stand up there and you tell these horrendous stories. None of that ever happened to me. Can't you see me someday stand up before a podium in Alcoholics Anonymous and say, my name is Faye, I'm an alcoholic, and one night I got drunk and cut my foot and came to AA. Don't laugh at me. And I tell you that, and you laugh. You laugh with me. You see, isn't it joyful? That is the worst thing that this illness ever did to me, other than what happened in my heart and in my head. My skid row was inside of me, and I lived in that scum every day until I got to you. This old timer, in his wisdom, did not try again to tell me I was an alcoholic. He said, so if you are an alcoholic and you drink again, all those things will begin to happen to you. And on the way home, I thought, that may be true, but I'm not drinking. I quit going to Alcoholics Anonymous because I convinced myself that I had been powerless for a while over alcohol. But now that I was not drinking a day at a time, my life was not unmanageable, and I could be fine, thank you very much. And I was back the following year in worse shape than I'd ever been in my life. And this time, the withdrawal was very hard. And this time I prayed for a sponsor. 2 days in sobriety, I was on my knees, And I was saying, God, if you exist, if you're there, if you're real, the people in AA tell me that I have to have a God of my understanding in order to get sober. I can't drink and I can't not drink. If you're there, disclose yourself to me. I had read that in the big book, that when we draw near to him, he discloses himself to us. And from that moment, I knew that I did not have to drink again as long as I live if I do this one day at a time. One day at a time. And suddenly I realized that these steps are a design for living. It's not something we work one time. We live these steps. We work them until they begin to be an internal experience that's a way of living, that keeps me reasonably sane and happy. And I realize that the time is getting on, but I want to share with you that through prayer, 2 days into sobriety, the woman I walked up to and said, "Will you be my sponsor?" As the words came out of my mouth, I thought, "Oh God, no, not this one." I knew this woman. This woman had never been married, did not have children, and was the boss where she worked. And I knew I needed a woman with a grudge at home, with kids that kept bringing their problems home for me to solve, with a boss that didn't understand me. And this woman was the exact opposite of what I needed. All I needed from my sponsor was sobriety. I needed a woman in recovery that knew that the solution to all my problems were in the pages of the big book in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the gift that woman gave me. And I'd call with my problems, who did this, they said that. And she'd say, "You can't change it, you can't fix it, and you can't control it." And she'd laugh. And I'd get so angry with her. And she'd say, "Anything beyond the tip of your nose is none of your business. It's God's world out there. They belong to God. Those are not your kids. That's not your husband. They're God's kids. Leave them alone. What are you doing about you?" And because that woman walked me into that kind of sobriety, that everything beyond the tip of my nose, I'm totally powerless over. When I had 90 days of sobriety, my husband came to me and said, "If you think I'm going to stay married to a woman that's in an AA meeting every night, you're crazy. When are you going to quit going to those meetings?" And I said, "Bob, I can't quit going to those meetings. I'm an alcoholic." And he said, "You have a decision to make. It's either them or me." 90 days into sobriety, I had that decision to make. And suddenly I realized that because it was beyond the tip of my nose, it was not anything to do with me. And I was able to say, "It's not my decision, Bob, it's yours. You can stay or you can leave. I hope you stay. But if you do stay, I'll be at an AA meeting every day. I have to do that for me." And I waited for him to leave. One day at a time, he didn't. And 3 months later, that man came to me in our kitchen on a Sunday afternoon and said, literally said, "I want what you have. I don't ever want to drink again as long as I live. Please tell me how to do it." And because I was so well sponsored into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to look at him again and say, "God, I can't help you. But I know some people who can, and I'll be glad to take you to them. Would you like to go?" And he said, "Please." And I brought him to you, and I gave him to you. And he's not had a drink for 14 years. This is the same man that I told my sponsor when I had 2 days of sobriety that I could not live in the house with that man and get sober, and she said, "Nonsense." I said, "He's drinking every night." She said, "Nonsense. That's none of your business. If you predicate your sobriety on what that man does or does not do, if you predicate your sobriety on who drinks and who doesn't, you will never be a free woman. You're going to get in the pages of the big book, and you're going to learn what freedom from bondage is all about." The following year, when I had 1 year of sobriety, my twin brother flew all the way from Georgia to find out how I was able to stay sober one day at a time and told me, I want what you have. And I said, I can't help you, but I know some people who can. And my husband and I took my twin brother to an AA meeting, and he's been sober ever since. When I had 2 years of sobriety, my twin brother came home to celebrate, or came to Arkansas to celebrate his 1 year birthday. And my husband and my twin brother and I were on the way out the back door to go to an AA meeting, and our son pulled in the driveway from Fayetteville, from college. And he walked in and hugged his favorite uncle, that's his namesake, and he said, I just got on the way to an AA meeting, and I said, yes, and he said, can I go? And I said, no. And he said, why not? And I said, because the meeting tonight is closed. If you wait till Monday, I'll take you to an open meeting. And he said, what's the difference? And I told him. And he said, I said, in order to go to a closed meeting, you have to have a desire to stop drinking. And he said, but Mom, I do. That's what I'm trying to tell you. I need help. Can I go too? And it was such a privilege that we all were able to take him to his first AA meeting. But when he told me that, my knees gave way, and I sat down in the kitchen, and I looked up, and there were three strong men looking down at me. My husband, my twin brother, and my son. And all I had done was get sober for me. This is a program of attraction. This is a program of attraction. My daughter came to me a couple of years later. And she said, Mom, I have a problem and you have a solution, and I think you know what I mean. Will you help me? And I thought, my God, I wonder how much money she needs now. And I said, what is your problem? And she said, Mom, I'm an alcoholic. I need help. So my husband and I took her to her first meeting, and she's been sober ever since. I watched my daughter, who's custody of two children, go through three marriages as a result of this illness. When she lost custody of the last child, I sat in the courtroom and held my baby daughter, a grown woman, but she was my baby, and knew the gut-wrenching feeling of watching my grandson taken from her because of this illness, knowing she could have no more children, and she, all she ever wanted from the time she was a baby was to be a mother. And she lost that privilege because of this illness. And I had to testify in that court of law to my own alcoholism to prove me an unfit grandmother. And she lost custody. And one day at a time, I prayed for the other grandmother who had set that ball in motion. And I have since come to be very appreciative of that woman for giving that child a home. You see, my daughter hit bottom within a week and came to you. And last week, the court awarded her full custody of that child and gave her guardianship of the other woman, grandmother's estate. She died a few months ago. And my daughter is a very good mother. She's sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a wonderful, beautiful daughter in Alma. We have three Alateens and the grandchildren. We all work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, or Alateen, for ourselves, not each other. And it works. One 12-step call, one call made to a central office of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you have put my entire life back together. I'm still in the same office. I'm still married to the same man. But my life has totally changed. And tonight I kept an appointment made by God, and it's been my privilege. Thank you.